ACATRA Foundation presents the ACATRA Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of ACATRA AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're jumping into a story you might think you know, but probably don't. Not really. It's Shoe Dog, a memoir by the creator of Nike, by Phil Knight.
Yeah, it's way more than just, you know, sneakers and swooshes.
Exactly. It's this really raw, human story about grit, about almost failing countless times.
Mm.
It might just change how you think about building something, anything, really.
Totally. And Knight himself, the book just shatters that image of the slick CEO with some grand vision from day one. He was basically this shy, kind of awkward accountant from Portland, Oregon.
Middle class background, right.
And somehow he co-founds Nike. But the book shows it was this messy, stumble-forward process. He calls his initial idea the crazy idea, and he's constantly fighting battles, banks, suppliers, competitors, even the U.S. government at one point.
It sounds exhausting.
Oh, it was. But that relentless drive, it didn't just build a company. It accidentally created this huge cultural force that changed sports, marketing, everything. It's such a relevant story today for anyone, you know, trying to make something happen.
Okay, let's definitely unpack that.
Yeah.
So where does this journey start for Phil Knight? What were his roots?
Well, he was born back in 1938 in Portland, Oregon. His dad, Bill Knight, was a newspaper publisher. Pretty respected, but also demanding. You get the sense he instilled this intense work ethic in Phil, maybe mixed with a bit of fear of not measuring up.
Okay.
And his mom, Dot Knight, she was a homemaker, but the book describes her as having this iron will underneath a polite exterior.
In Portland itself, the Pacific Northwest, that seems important too, the whole outdoor running culture there.
Oh, absolutely central. Running was huge there. And for Phil, who was naturally pretty introverted, running became his thing, his sanctuary almost. He found comfort in just moving more than talking.
Like a moving meditation, you could say.
Yeah, kind of. And you see that thread continue through high school track. And then at the University of Oregon, he ran under Bill Bowerman, the legendary coach.
Ah, Bowerman. He becomes a huge figure later.
Huge. And Bowerman really shaped his thinking. Running wasn't just physical. It taught you about solitude, mental strength, pushing your limits. Bowerman suggested running was a way to understand the world.
So this running obsession follows him to Stanford Business School. And that's where the crazy idea really clicks, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a class paper.
Exactly. The paper was basically, can Japanese shoes do to German shoes what Japanese cameras did to journal cameras? He saw this opening for high-quality, low-cost running shoes from Japan to take on Adidas and Puma.
Which were dominant then.
Totally dominant. So yeah. This paper wasn't just homework. It was like the seed of everything. Mm-hmm. And that idea directly leads to his big 1962 trip around the world. The absolute key moment is in Kobe, Japan. He walks into the Onitsuka company they made Tiger shoes.
Right.
And just completely improvises, says he represents a company called Blue Ribbon Sports.
Which didn't exist.
Didn't exist at all, just in his head. But somehow, this incredibly bold, maybe crazy move works. He gets samples and a shaky distribution deal.
Wow. That takes some nerve. So he gets back, has these shoes. How does Blue Ribbon Sports, BRS, actually start? It must have been tiny.
Tiny is an understatement. He was literally selling shoes from the trunk of his car, his Plymouth Valiant specifically. Mm-hmm. He'd go to track meets, use his credibility as a runner.
While still working his accounting job.
Yep, still crunching numbers to pay the bills. BRS was this all-consuming side project, constantly eating cash, always feeling like it was about to collapse, just pure bootstrapping. Then 1964, a massive step. Bill Bowerman comes on board. He invests $500.
His old coach.
His old coach. And that $500 wasn't just money. It was credibility, connections. Plus, Bowerman was an inventor at heart, always tinkering to make shoes better. Their partnership was perfect. Knight's business drive, Bowerman's innovation focus.
That really changes the game. And wasn't there another key early person? Jeff Johnson?
Yes, Jeff Johnson, the first full-time employee. Another running nut like them. He was obsessive about customer service, opened the first actual BRS store, kept these detailed index cards on every customer.
Building that loyal base person by person.
Exactly. He really helped forge that early Nike culture of, you know, authentic connection. And yeah, he was part of that core group Knight later affectionately called his butt face team.
Their name always stands out. It sounds harsh, but it meant loyalty, right?
Absolutely. It was his term for this inner circle. They were incredibly dedicated, maybe a bit quirky, but fiercely loyal and resilient. And they needed that resilience because things got really tense with Onitsuka.
That Japanese supplier.
Yeah. It became unreliable, tried to cut BRS out entirely around 1971. It forced Knight into a corner, create his own brand, fast, or lose everything.
So that's the birth of Nike. Out of crisis.
Out of crisis. It was hurried. Jeff Johnson actually suggested the name, Nike Greek Goddess of Victory. And the logo, the swoosh, designed by a student, Carolyn Davidson, for just $35.
$35. Unbelievable, considering what it became. You gotta wonder what she thinks now.
Right. And then comes another iconic moment, the waffle iron innovation. That was pure Bowerman.
Tell us about that.
He's literally in his garage, messing around, trying to create a better sole. He pours rubber into his wife's waffle iron.
No way.
Yes. And it creates this revolutionary studded sole that became the waffle trainer, and it just exploded. It really put Nike on the map as a serious innovator. But the struggles just kept coming. There was a nasty legal fight with Onitsuka, which they eventually won, thankfully. But then this huge blow from U.S. Customs in 75-76.
What happened there?
A competitor complained, triggering this investigation. Customs hit them with a bill for $25 million in retroactive duties.
$25 million.
Yeah, which was more than the entire company was worth back then. It pushed them right to the edge of bankruptcy again.
Just crisis after crisis. It's incredible they survived.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads towards the IPO, the stock offering. In 1980, they managed the customs thing, right? Mm-hmm. Negotiated down.
They did. Got it down to $9 million, which was still enormous, but manageable. But that whole ordeal, plus their explosive growth, made the IPO necessary. They needed the capital.
But was Knight worried about that? About going public? Maybe losing that rebellious butt-face culture?
Oh, definitely. The book makes it clear he was really ambivalent. He knew it was necessary for growth, but he worried about losing that scrappy, close-knit vibe. He kind of mourned the end of the BRS era.
I can understand that. So, looking back, what's his professional legacy?
Well, huge, obviously. He proved small companies could take on giants through innovation, building real customer bonds, and taking smart risks. Nike just rewrote the playbook for sports marketing, athlete endorsements, like with Steve Prefontaine, their first big star, and just building an incredibly powerful brand.
And culturally. Just do it alone.
Right. That campaign and just Nike's whole vibe, it fundamentally changed how we think about sports, achievement, personal potential. And their global reach wasn't just selling products. It was spreading this culture, this idea worldwide. And then there's the human level. The memoir itself is a big part of his legacy, I think. It's so honest about the cost, the struggle, the vulnerability, and his philanthropy later in life, like giving hundreds of millions to Stanford and Oregon. It shows this attempt to balance that fierce ambition with a broader purpose.
It's quite a trajectory. So if we distill all that, what was Phil Knight's core philosophy? What really drove him through all the ups and downs?
I think a key part was what you might call authentic competition. He genuinely believed that striving against strong competitors made everyone better. It wasn't just about winning. It was about pushing the whole industry forward through relentless innovation. Almost a moral stance, you know?
That's interesting. Competition is a force for collective improvement, not just market share. What else?
Well, there was definitely productive dissatisfaction. He was just never satisfied. Always pushing, always looking for the next edge, the next improvement. That constant restlessness must have been exhausting, but it absolutely fueled Nike's growth. Contentment wasn't really in his vocabulary.
Keeps you moving forward, I guess. And relationships. He was introverted, but those early bonds seemed crucial.
Absolutely crucial. Despite being shy, he understood the immense power of authentic relationships with Bowerman, with that butt-face team, with the athletes. These were built on shared obsession and deep mutual respect. Those bonds held the company together through the worst times.
Okay, so those are sort of his operating principles. But what about his deeper motivations? Clearly more than just money.
Oh, for sure. There's this real sense of competence motivation.
Yeah.
He needed to prove his crazy idea wasn't crazy, that he could build this thing, beat the odds, beat the giants. There was also, I think, an aesthetic motivation, a real belief in the beauty and power of well-designed shoes to help athletes perform better.
Like art and function combined.
Exactly. And then deeply personal stuff, proving himself to his demanding father, maybe to Bowerman, definitely to himself. Business became the arena where this quiet, intelligent guy could really compete and win.
And when things got really tough, those near-death moments for the company, how did he cope? What was his approach to adversity?
He talks about it almost like running a long race. He had this metabolic approach. Part of it was compartmentalization, dealing with the immediate fire without losing sight of the finish line, the long-term goal.
Staying focused under pressure.
Right. And when the usual ways didn't work, he'd escalate. Resourcefulness escalation, you could call it, getting more creative, more desperate, finding unconventional solutions. And finally, relationship leverage. In every crisis, he turned to his network, Bowerman, his team, lawyers, bankers. He knew he couldn't solve it alone.
That network again. So important. Okay, this is fascinating. Let's zero in on some specific moments. You mentioned turning points. Can we identify three truly pivotal ones that really changed everything for Knight and Nike?
Yeah, and what's striking is how much risk was involved in each. Okay, first one. The Onitsuka Company meeting in 1962. We touched on it, but just think. He walks in, basically lies about representing a company.
The Phantom Blue Ribbon Sports.
Exactly. Why it mattered so much. It set the pattern for his whole career. Act boldly, maybe before you're totally ready, then scramble like mad to make it work. And how it changed him. Pulling off that bluff gave him this core confidence. He learned he could navigate tricky situations with preparation, guts, and figuring things out on the fly.
Okay, that initial leap of faith, or maybe bluff, what's number two?
Number two has to be Bill Bowerman's partnership decision in 1964. Knight goes to his old coach, this respected figure, asks him to partner up. Bowerman says yes, puts in $500.
Which doesn't sound like much now, but then.
It was huge validation why it mattered. It instantly transformed BRS from Knight, selling shoes out of his car, into a real company with innovation potential and industry credibility. And how it changed Knight. It taught him the incredible power of teaming up with people who have complementary skills. And it embedded product innovation, not just distribution, right into the company's DNA from the start.
From solo act to powerful duo. Got it. And the third turning point.
The third, and maybe the most dramatic, was the split from Onitsuka in 1971. After all those years building the U.S. market for Tiger shoes, Onitsuka tries to cut him out, take it all back.
Betrayal, essentially.
Total betrayal. Knight's facing ruin. Why it mattered. This crisis forced the creation of Nike. He had no choice but to build his own brand, find manufacturing, create an identity, all from scratch, under immense pressure. And the change in him. Surviving that near-death experience, then succeeding with Nike, gave him this unshakable belief in their ability to overcome anything. It hammered home the lesson. True security only comes from controlling your own destiny.
Wow. Those three moments, you can really see the company and Knight himself being forged in fire. So let's bring it back to the listener. Thinking about our own lives, our own challenges, what are the big human lessons here?
Well, the first one that jumps out is about persistence through uncertainty. Knight's story screams that meaningful things rarely happen easily or quickly. You have to keep going through doubt, fear, failure, near collapse. Remember that quote he told his team?
The one about cowards and the weak?
Yeah, the cowards never started and the weak died along the way. That leaves us, ladies and gentlemen, us. It's about sheer grit when everything tells you to quit.
That really resonates. It's easy to forget the struggle behind big successes. What else?
Second big lesson. Authentic relationships generate exponential returns. Nike survived because of the loyalty and shared drive of that core butt-faced team. Johnson, Woodell, Strasser, Hayes. They trusted each other. They believed in the mission. It really highlights how crucial trust and collaboration are, especially when things get tough.
That team dynamic seems so vital. And innovation.
Right. Third lesson. Innovation is often born from necessity and obsession. The waffle iron wasn't just a happy accident. It came from Bowerman's relentless drive to solve a problem, how to give runners better traction. It shows breakthroughs often happen when you're intensely focused on a need and willing to experiment, even in weird ways.
Like using kitchen appliances.
Okay,
and the book is also very honest about the personal cost, isn't it?
Extremely honest. That's the fourth lesson. The personal sacrifices of the entrepreneurial journey are real. Knight doesn't shy away from the strain on his marriage, admitting he was an absent husband and father for long stretches. And the most heartbreaking part is the loss of his son, Matthew, which he says completely changed his perspective on what success even means. It's a sobering reality check for anyone chasing big ambitions.
A very human element. What about failure? He faced so much of it.
Yeah. Lesson five is redefine failure. Near bankruptcy, bad products, betrayals. They happen constantly. But Knight and his team learned not to see them as dead ends. They were problems to solve, data points, lessons learned. That ability to bounce back, to learn from mistakes, became embedded in Nike's risk-taking culture.
Don't let setbacks stop you. Learn from them. Makes sense.
And finally, number six, embrace your quirks. Knight wasn't your typical charismatic CEO. He was shy, a bit awkward, but he built a company that reflected him and his equally quirky team. He loved that patent quote, "Don't tell people how to do things. Tell them what to do and let them surprise you with their results." It's a great message. You don't have to fit some mold. Lean into who you are.
Be authentically yourself, even as a leader. That's powerful. Okay, let's try to boil this incredible story down. If you had to give our listeners three final takeaways from Phil Knight's life and the story of Nike, what would they be?
Okay, three takeaways. First, an emotional insight. True success and maybe even personal growth seems to come from embracing paradox. Knight was fiercely driven, yet somehow humble, incredibly persistent, yet also flexible when needed. It's navigating those tensions, those contradictions within yourself that builds real strength.
Interesting. Confidence and humility together. Mm-hmm. Okay, what's the intellectual insight?
An intellectual insight. Shoe Dog is basically a masterclass in strategic thinking under pressure, especially with limited resources. It shows you how high-stakes decisions get made. Gather information, weigh options, lean on your network, but always keep that long-term vision in mind, even when you're fighting fires.
So it's a practical guide to decision-making in chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And the final universal lesson.
A universal insight. This one feels the most broadly applicable. It's about finding and chasing your authentic calling, even if everyone else thinks it's a crazy idea. That pursuit, that commitment through all the uncertainty and setbacks is what leads to both meaning and, often, success. As Knight puts it, and it's worth repeating, seek a calling. If you're following your calling, the fatigue will be easier to bear, the disappointments will be fuel, the highs will be like nothing you've ever felt.
That's a fantastic place to leave it. Find your calling and embrace the journey. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.